Excellent. There
All
we go.
Right.
Good evening.
Good evening, or night.
Oh, good morning, actually.
Oh, little after midnight, yes.
It's 12:30. We've been watching Future Man.
Rough cuts of Future Man. More than rough, I'd say.
Locked cuts with some holes.
Yes. Very fun stuff. We've talked about Future Man before, but it's a great show. And when does season two premiere?
Season two, I believe, premieres actually not until January, unfortunately. But we get to see
the cuts, which is good. It's such fun.
It's this wonderful combination when you work on a show of seeing on screen scripts you've read and then seeing on screen scripts you've shot and the differences between them and the connection between them. It's wonderful.
It's fantastic. It's good. So, well, hi, Adam.
Eben, how are you?
I'm well. So, welcome back to Mythmakers.
Yes.
This is our podcast all about storytelling and the process and power of story.
Yes.
So, I am Eben Matthews.
I am Adam Martin.
And we have together about over 40 years of experience developing, creating, and delivering
content. See, I object to the 40 years thing. Because that makes it sound really old.
No, it makes it sound really experienced. We've done a lot of this stuff in many different ways and places and things.
We have, but I feel like there's an inherent elderliness.
Together. So, you know, we're 22. We've been doing this since we were two years old. You know?
As long as we can claim some completely arbitrary and totally false age, that sounds fine.
We're very virile.
Yes. We were young and early adopters of everything.
That's right. Great. Exactly. Yes, we're very, very hip.
And definitely.
And masculine.
What he says.
Yes, all of those. Yes. All of those things. Yes.
Masculine?
I don't know.
Odd adjective to use in particular context. I'm a great filmmaker. I'm really virile.
You know, just the right number of scars to be.
Oh, yeah. Make it look about it's really lived. That's great. Sorry, it was a Future Man quote.
Yes. So, welcome to our show. It's late.
It's late. We've had some drinks. Yep, it's all good.
A little tired.
Yes. It's all good.
All right, so good stuff. So, let's kind of dive right in. So, I mean, we're going to talk about some pre-production stuff in general, and it's very much off the back of what we've been doing today.
Yes.
So we are in the throes of getting ready to start shooting some stuff, some live-action stuff.
For Yarn.
For this. It hasn't officially been announced yet, so we probably shouldn't say exactly what we're doing. But we have already talked about the fact that we are officially making a bunch of content.
A lot of content for that stuff.
For the Yarn platform.
Yep.
So writing, directing, and producing a whole slew of stuff, which will be hitting leading up to
September through October and beyond.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So lots more to say about that as it develops. But in these early stages, so we've written scripts and we know what the story of everything is, and so now the kind of rubber meets the road. As far as the realities of like, okay, so we know what these things are and these pieces that we need to create. How are we going to create them?
Right, exactly. And I think it's worth saying at this point, so like the Yarn format is very much, you know, it's this text-based storytelling, which is incredibly effective when it's done well. And interspersed in there are live action elements. They can be photographs, they can be video, they can be, audio, whatever it is.
You know, we've talked about this in regards to Dead Town, which we also have running on Yarn right now, and more of that coming as well. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing about the format, and it's, you know, I think we've said before, it's like, you know, the initial reaction, which we had and which other people we've mentioned it to have initially had, is sort of like, really?
Yeah.
But then you kind of get into it and realize like how compelling this format is. And it's, you know, the basic premise is that you're sort of eavesdropping or viewing different characters' text conversations. And so you're literally kind of reading the back and forth, essentially dialogue between different characters, you know, presented as if you're literally watching their texting unfold. And what I've come to believe about the format, and part of why it's so compelling, is it's this kind of combination of a sort of voyeuristic element with the kind of a visceral relationship to a format that we literally use every single day. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, it's a consumption medium in the sense that you're, you know, kind of you're tapping through, but it's something that's being delivered to you. But I think there's this extra kind of psychological or, you know, kind of element to it that feels so visceral because unlike sitting back and watching a TV show, you are used to actually participating yes. in this on in a daily, you know, kind of real way.
Yeah.
And so it, you know, kind of creates this interesting sort of consumption medium in a format that is literally a part of our everyday lives as far as the way that we communicate and the way that we interact mm-hmm. with other people.
And I think it's worth saying that it's funny because I think my initial reaction to it as someone who's grown up in a more kind of traditional film
yeah.
you know, industry mm-hmm. and entertainment, was one of skepticism.
Yeah,
and it's been fascinating. We said before, it's been fascinating watching this develop and watching our own ability to tell stories in this fashion. Mm-hmm. But when stories are told well, like in any medium, it's incredibly effective.
Yeah.
And there have been stories that are literally, and it's funny because I think the ghost stories especially, the mm-hmm. kind of creepy, edgy mm-hmm. ones, mm-hmm. work amazingly well. Other ones absolutely do as well, but there's something very, you know, genuinely kind of spine-tingling yeah. about some of this stuff.
Yeah,
but it's, absolutely. It's great to be able yeah. to explore this, you know, explore a new storytelling technique.
It is, yeah.
It's a lot of fun.
And so where that dovetails into what we're doing now, which is especially exciting, kind of moving into doing stuff, which we've, you know, it's honestly been one of the things we've wanted to do for mm-hmm. you know, since we kind of started working together, is do more and more kind of live action work together as yes. well. And so part of the format is, you know, just like in a regular text conversation, you can send pictures, you can mm-hmm. send videos. And so, you know, we can use these different media elements to enhance the storytelling and to deliver, you know, things in a visual way that, you know, tell pieces of these stories in that fashion that still feels congruent with the format.
Yes.
But also kind of expands the scope of the world and allows us to use actors and characters and media in a way. Yes. to kind of build these worlds out that we're developing. And so, mm-hmm. you know, just in a very, you know, tangible way, it also presents these, you know, different types of challenges. And that, you know, that's what we were working on today is, you know, one of the tools in the toolbox is, you know, kind of a FaceTime style yep. conversation exactly. between two characters. And so you start to realize like, well, okay, so, you know, our initial thought was like, great, you can put two actors on FaceTime and record
and
screen record yeah. that conversation mm-hmm. and you kind of have what you need. And then all of a sudden we realize, well, wait a second, you actually can't do that because you don't get the audio
yes.
because the way that the FaceTime screen recording works is it records the video but doesn't record the audio.
Curious.
So that yes. led us, you know, down a little rabbit hole of like, okay, what if we tried
this? A few hours of experimentation later.
And we finally kind of cracked the way to do that mm-hmm. in a couple different ways. And so, you know, figuring out how do you do that when two characters are in the same set or environment
space, how do you
versus
when they're,
when they're not exactly and so. both of those scenarios happen in these stories and so, you know, we kind of figured out how to do that. And I think it's, you know, part of this pre-production for this, but I, you know, I think pre-production for any project is a sort of problem solving component, which is like you kind of identify, okay, here are these elements that I need, whether that's, you know, a technocrane and Tom Cruise
right.
and an airplane
right.
or it's, you know, two people on a FaceTime conversation and one of them is outside and one of them is inside. Yes. And then, you know, what are those elements and how are those elements going to come together to create this, you know, content that's needed to mm-hmm. tell the story that you're trying to tell.
Exactly. And do it in such a way that is compelling and moves the content, moves the story forward.
Exactly. Yes. So I think, you know, it's like I always like to think about this in a kind of cross-platform way because we work with a lot of stuff in different media and we hope that people listening are doing a bunch of different things. And so, yep. you know, it's the, you know, Adam can speak a little more to the kind of traditional, you know, live action film and television part of this. But, you know, it's like when we're doing animation, when we're doing comics, when we're doing, you know, this type of stuff, you know, it becomes this sort of, you know, puzzle pieces out on the table kind of situation where you're then kind of piecing things together to figure out, okay, so here's something we need to figure out how we're going to do. Okay, if that doesn't work, how are we covering that base so that we know that we've got a backup plan? You know, part of what we were doing today as well is figuring out like, okay, where are we going to shoot these things? And so, you know, this is it's a relatively comparatively low budget production. Oh, yeah. So it's also kind of figuring out, you know, how do we get what we need and have it look great and feel great and feel like, you know, what it needs to be in this context,
tell the story, but also and do it in a practical, efficient way.
Exactly. Yes.
And I feel like this is something that's very, it's the bread and butter of what I do as an AD. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating, the kind of slight shift when it's your own material that you're working from and doing. Because it is very much the, you know, typically in television, and I think most entertainment, aside from the biggest, you know, you'll get your kind of first concept writer's pass at an episode of television, for example. And that... And quite rightly so, the writers are completely unshackled. Great, whatever you want to write, what's the story, how do you tell it, where do you want to go? If you want to be on top of the Eiffel Tower in this moment, and you want to be at a nightclub in Beverly Hills the next, and you want to be in Covent Garden in London after that, how, you know, all fine. Put it all out there, write your ideal, and then you have to apply the money to it, and then you realize, wait a second, okay, if we don't do these things, that's going to cost us X million over budget, therefore we have to find a way to shoot this in a way that fits the pattern that we have and the money that we have to do this.
The time.
And the time and all those things. Yeah. And so then comes the process of the kind of, I mean, we used to call it, I mean, at various places you kind of call it killing your babies, which is a little harsh, but is very much appropriate. But, you know, it's you're looking at how can I still tell this story, but do it in a way that fits what we are actually able to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, this scene would be great on the top floor of the Eiffel Tower, unless we are Mission Impossible. But we can't do that.
Right.
So can you tell that same story on green screen, which is an option, or in a car on the way to the Eiffel Tower, which means you've got to do some poor man's process in a car, which is just shooting a car, making it look like it's moving, with green screen outside of the windows, and then you add Paris to the background, then you add an establishing shot of the Eiffel Tower, and then there you go. Do you shoot, you find stock footage, you know, existing footage of the Eiffel Tower, and then you're cutting to a coffee shop set up on the Eiffel Tower with green screen around it. Therefore, you're able to, you know, look at these are the things you can do to still tell the story and get across what you need to convey to the audience while doing it within the parameters of the show.
Yes,
and I think this is, you know, and again, with the exception of the biggest names in entertainment, this is a process every single person on both, you know, above or below the line goes through on every single show, every single episode of every single television movie, whatever you want to name. So it sounds very familiar, and yet is slightly different kind of shade put on it by the fact that it's our own material and production, and how do we achieve this?
Yes.
And it's actually kind of fun.
It is actually kind of fun. It is fun, and it's, you know, it's, you know, one of the things I think, and it's even interesting talking to our you know, clients and collaborators at Mammoth, in that, you know, the company that makes the ARM platform. So, you know, as we've gotten into more of the production side of this, you know, even in conversations with them, I think, you know, what we have been able to kind of bring to this particular type of storytelling is actually a real desire to kind of actually lean into the limitations in a way that, in some cases seems even surprising to them, which is to, you know, just to really embrace the format, to embrace the fact that, you know, okay, we know we're going to be limited in particular areas. And so how do we actually use that as an asset rather than a liability? And it makes me think of, you know, one of my favorite stories for kind of indie film is, you know, Robert Rodriguez talking about, you know, creating or, you know, writing his first feature, El Mariachi, and, you know, talking about the script writing process. Actually, for him, part of the beginnings of that process was like, you know, what do I actually already have access to? And so, you know, it's like, okay, I've got a guitar. I've got a, you know, I've got access to this town in Mexico because of this friend that lives there, and I've got a turtle. And so those things are going to go in the script and kind of be featured heavily in the script, and kind of working around these, you know, assets and leaning very much into them. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, I think that especially when you're dealing with some, you know, budget constraints and, you know, kind of production constraints, it's like you can still be very creative and very, you know, kind of, you know, kind of really embrace the broad, you know, story that message, you want to tell, but do it in a way that makes sense with what resources are actually in hand.
Yeah. And I think a very famous example of that is actually, look, golly, 40 years. Mm-hmm. It was 74, I think, that Jaws was released.
Yeah, yeah.
And you look at the effectiveness of that film and the fact that they had this gigantic rubber shark that looked terrible.
Yeah.
And they had planned that this thing was going to look good and they were going to feature the shark. And then they decided, having seen it, this isn't going to work. Yeah. We need to hide this thing for as long as possible. And so literally you see a shark's fin for three quarters of the film.
Yeah.
And then you see this gigantic shark. But by that time, you're invested enough. So even if the shark looks a bit fake, you're able to wrap your head around the fact that this is a real thing destroying this boat, which is the first time you see it. It's in the last act of the movie.
And it makes
it's so good. It works so well. I mean, but that's a great example of embracing one's limitations.
It's a great example. And it actually makes the movie. I mean, it's like, you know, had the shark worked, it probably wouldn't have been anywhere near as good.
Exactly.
So it's, yeah, I think it's...
And obviously, you look at Alien or something. And it's a very classic monster movie trope. You don't show the creature. Mm-hmm. You know, you look at an alien. Now, Ridley Scott did not have that problem. The alien in Alien looked amazing.
Yes.
And did from beginning to end.
Yeah.
And hiding it that long just upped the ante.
Exactly.
So you could have got away with showing it less if you needed to.
Exactly.
That's great.
Yeah. So, yeah. So I think, you know, it's something we, you know, in different variations, you know, we deal with these question marks, you know, in kind of everything that we do. So, you know, on the animation project that we've been working on with Back to Earth and that we're someday gonna wrap up, it's like, you know, there we're dealing with a different set of constraints. So there it's around, you know, what scenes are we gonna spend, you know, the most time on creating the most sophisticated animation so that the rest of it can be much simpler.
Exactly.
And you kind of build this experience of something being more elaborate than it actually really is based on these sort of key moments.
Right.
And, you know, that factors into this stuff as well.
Oh, always. So, and I think it does, you know, I think, and this is where, you know, as writers and creators, and I think you see this in, I've certainly seen this in Future Man, and I think our last, and you see it in varying degrees across the board in entertainment. You know, if you've got an elaborate set piece to produce and film and direct and all those things to, how do you, on a, if you are embracing your constraints, if you accept we have 11 days to shoot this thing,
right,
and we want to spend, we have a gigantic action sequence that is gonna, you know, script wise takes 2 pages of a 32 page script to shoot, but we need to make it impressive, therefore we're gonna take 14 hours, an entire day plus, to film. How do we mitigate the impact that has on the rest of the show?
Right.
Well, that means you need to spend, you need to be able to chomp through 7 or 8 pages a day for a few days with 2 or 3 actors talking, and do it, shoot it in such a way that you'll do that in 11 hours a day.
Yes.
So that then you can take the day it needs to shoot this big action sequence or this big, you know, you look at, you know, My Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. You know, these big, elaborate song and dance numbers in that.
Yes.
How do you... Okay, great. This is going to take half a day to shoot this. So what do I need to do in order to accommodate that shoot?
Yeah.
And I think that's just part of the filmmaking process.
Yes.
And until you are David Fincher, Michael Bay, Chris Nolan...
Right.
You're going to have the, you know, a few others, obviously.
Yes.
Shonda, you know, Ryan Murphy, you know, in television-wise.
Yeah.
But how do you how do you do that and still do that effectively,
yeah,
and tell that story effectively is great.
Yeah.
And so for us today, it was very much looking at, okay, these are all the little elements we need to shoot. And the way yarn works is there's kind of 2 to 4 media elements.
Yes.
In every episode that is created.
Yes.
And those, the majority of those are stills, still photos.
Yeah.
But there are elements within each of those that need to be created. So you need this letter that needs to be photographed, that a photo of this letter is now text through somebody. So you've got to create a letter, you've got to write the letter, you've got to shoot it in a location that works. Now, because it's just a letter, you can probably knock it out on the table next to 10 other things that you need to film.
Exactly.
And you can put them one next door to the other and dink, 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 dink. And as long as they're in separate storylines, you're never going to know, and it's fine.
Yeah.
So we were then today looking at, all right, we have these kind of 3 major sets that we have to shoot on and create within this world in order to tell these stories. These are the things we need. So how do we do that effectively? Well, the bulk of our stories take place at night. Okay, but we don't actually need night for most of these set pieces. Right. We can do a filter and we're shooting inside, and therefore actually we can shoot day for night for most of these things.
Yep.
But we've got someone spying on a chap walking into his house across the street at night.
Mm-hmm.
That clearly has to be night. We need somebody walking into a house full of policemen on the way to a murder. That clearly has to be at night.
Yeah.
But the rest of the stuff, oh, we can actually cheat it.
Kind of fake it, yeah.
All right, we need a workshop. Well, we can kind of cheat 2 walls of a set. You don't need to see 360 degrees in this workshop.
Yeah.
You need to see 180 degrees, which means you've got 2 walls of a set, and you can dress that out, and you can shoot it effectively in there.
Yep.
Can we then reuse that space? We change the dressing around, we add some shelves, we take some bust, whatever it is. We can then shoot that same exact space as, all right, it's this person's workshop, and now it's this person's hiding hole.
Chamber.
Or torture, whatever it might be. Exactly. And just knowing how to do that means that then we can structure a shoot day to be as effective as possible.
Yeah.
Where, you know, the biggest single, if you're bouncing around different locations, that just sucks time out of your your day and your production schedule. And that is time that doesn't show up on screen. And I think that's the biggest single lesson in all this stuff is, how do you maximize the impact of what ends up on screen?
Yeah.
And time spent doing anything else other than fucking shooting doesn't help. So how do you maximize the time you get that? You get 10 hours, 12 hours, whatever, to shoot this. Great. If we have to go to 10 different locations, we're wasting 5 hours of that time just bouncing traveling around, which doesn't help us.
Yeah.
If we can work out how to condense 10 locations into 3 places, now we have a real shot at getting all the spread that we need and the scope that we need and telling the story we want to tell without sacrificing the impact that it'll have on screen. So it means that time. And now, obviously, for us, it's different. We're, you know, like Adam was saying, relatively low budget shoot. But if you're on a, you know, you're on a normal show, you're burning $8,000 to $12,000 an hour filming.
Yeah.
Which means 15 minutes moving from set to set is $2,000 to $3,000 that you then don't get to spend
on
somewhere
what actually
else
goes on screen. Yeah.
And
yeah.
So is that a difference between a VFX shot that you really actually wanted versus I'm going to move next door? Well, let's have the VFX shot and let's work out how to shoot that shot that we thought we wanted in this new location. Great, let's shoot that over here in a corner.
Yeah.
And that's it's part of the fun of the process to me, and I think it's probably just having done that for so many years now. Yeah. It's exciting. It's very exciting to get to do that now with our own stuff.
Yes, it is.
And working out the technical aspects of how to film it and what to do and how to get the actors. We know we can find great actors to do these roles.
Yeah.
So great. How do we then give them the space to do what they can do best?
Yes.
And capture those great performances in such a way that is then going to make everything else look better.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's the fun of the problem solving of this thing.
It is.
It's kind of great. It's kind of fun. It's cool.
It is. It's a lot of fun. So, yeah, so we're very excited about all this stuff. And, you know, the next couple of months, I think, are going to be a little crazy with getting all this stuff, you know, kind of not only shot, but then into post and put together and out the door and ready to go up on the platform. And
oh, good God.
Have lots more to talk about with all of that as well.
Palpitations.
So it's going to be a little nutty, but it's also going to be awesome. And then I think, you know, once we get through this first raft, then... you know, I think we'll have it kind of all dialed in. So it's always, you know, like with everything, it's like the calm before the storm and then the storm. And then you kind of know how to weather the next bit of it.
Kind of R&D process in terms of, okay, how do you actually effectively shoot a FaceTime conversation and give yourself the flexibility and post that you need? So the initial concept was great. We just FaceTime two actors and that's what we do. And then the complications of, oh, well, the audio doesn't record, so you need the video. But then actually, there's probably situations where you want control of the video independent of each other.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're just recording a screen grab, then, well, you can't adjust the picture. You want to see a bit more of the reactions of the person they're talking to. Well, they're this tiny block in the corner versus something a bit bigger that you can then... feel your way into.
Or even just, you know, we're realizing as we were doing some tests today, it's like, you know, there are situations in the scripts where, you know, it's like we want this all to look as natural and kind of real as possible, and yet, you know, there are probably moments where you do want to actually be able to even just color grade the two different shots, you know, in slightly different ways, or to, you know, really push the two, you know, different locations or different lighting situations or whatever, and just having that kind of level of control over the two elements that are going to be on screen. So, you know, it's like the trade-off between, you know, there's a, you know, especially for me initially thinking like, oh, you know, it's like, let's go for this sort of, you know, one and done kind of opportunity to kind of do it all at once. But realizing that, you know, even though that would be kind of the quickest and easiest path, you know, we're going to get a better result, you know, kind of spending a little extra time in post to kind
of
just nail it.
Though taking that concept of, okay, the benefit of, in this example, a FaceTime call is that you have the actors playing together, and against it's the immediate, the interaction of that will enhance the viewing.
Absolutely. The performances.
All that stuff. It's going to make it that much better.
Yeah.
So what do we do to bring that reality and that immediacy to our production process that will help the performance, that will end up on screen and will mean that we're shooting things that much quicker and easier than it would be if we're shooting one half of the conversation, then we totally different. We have to go and play the other half of the conversation with somebody else, and we have to do playback, and they have to react to the same thing, and it just complicates the whole process.
Yes.
Whereas, great, we've now figured out we can do this immediately. We can have the actors playing off each other, so we can shoot both sides of the conversation at once.
Yep.
And yes, we're putting it together in post, so it costs us a little extra time in post, but we get the flexibility we need and we get the performance we need. And I think that's
the best of all worlds. Absolutely.
And we years ago watching, I may have told the story before, forgive me if I have, but I was lucky enough to do three shows with John Frankenheimer.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
legendary director, John Frankenheimer.
Young people may not know who that is, but Manchurian Candidate was his most famous movie. He also did Ronin. He did won a bunch of Emmys, a couple of Oscar nominations under his belt. Like, classic old school directors. He was part of the rap, he ran with the Rat Pack crowd. He was with Robert Kennedy when he got shot at the ambassador. I mean, like, amazing director. And I remember watching him directing in his last movie a scene between Michael Gambon and Donald Sutherland.
Mm-hmm.
And we had shot The Master and we shot Donald's side of the coverage of the scene. And then we were shooting Michael, and Sir Michael, as he now is.
Yes.
And John, as the scene had progressed, John changed the performance in Michael. And I remember so clearly, I happened to be within earshot when he went up to Donald and said, look, I'm so sorry, we have to shoot your side of the coverage again, because I've changed Michael's performance, which means the reactions you were giving to him will no longer match
any sense,
the cut.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, we're going to go with this version of him, so I have to shoot you again. And it was just one of those kind of magical directorial lessons.
Yes.
And moments in terms of this is what counts. And if you can get that immediacy with the actors where you can change one performance, but because you're shooting both at once, you don't then have to take the time to go back and shoot it. You can just have them play and you're talking to both at the same time. It's like, great. Hey, we're going to do this now differently. So here's what's coming up. So now you need to play this in this way as opposed to this. So don't react. He's now going to play this not angry but sad. Therefore, you're reacting to sadness in him, which means you have to change your performance. So you're no longer, it's no longer confrontational. It's now, you're being sympathetic. Yeah, it's those, whatever that scenario is.
Yeah.
It's great to have the flexibility to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that is the benefit of shooting things simultaneously. It's the benefit you get certainly with comedy, with cross shooting, which is where you shoot kind of both. You have cameras set up either side of a conversation, you're shooting both things at the same time, and you're able to get an immediacy there. I think it works better with comedy than drama in general, but it's a fantastic tool to have in one's arsenal. And it's fun to have worked out how to do that for us for this next
week. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. No, it's very cool. I'm actually, as you know, it's like as we were kind of figuring it out and seeing it come together, it's actually, you know, it's made it more, even more exciting for me. It's like, I think it's going to work.
It's going to work. It's going to be great. And it's also really funny because, of course, it's Eben and I who are not actors walking around my house. Eben's outside, like pacing to and fro, and we're kind of just mumbling along, trying to improvise stuff. And,
I think these little silly tests are going to make it out at some point just for fun. But
I'm glad you think it's fun. I call it abject humiliation, but no, it's fine. I'm British. What do we know?
Yes, I think they're fun. I think they're fun. So
no, it's great.
Part of the process.
Yes, indeed.
Yes. So yeah. So I think, you know, the big takeaway is just, you know, I think whatever it is that you're trying to make, it's, you know, it's worth putting in the time to kind of figure all this stuff out ahead of time, and whatever media it is, you know, working with the people that you're collaborating with to kind of find the best processes, the best, you know.
Exactly.
Kind of, the more you have going into the actual work, the better.
The better prepped you are going into it, like the worst possible time. And it doesn't matter if you're spending nothing or spending, you know, big days on big action movies. I mean, Transformers, the burn rate was kind of $450,000 a day, $500,000 a day on the big scenes. Pearl Harbor was $500,000.
Yeah.
Like, every minute you're not filming is costing you a fucking fortune. Obviously, we don't have that issue right now. But the most expensive, the most nerve-wracking and aggravating time to be working out any of this stuff is when you have actors ready to go on film and you have a bump. And hiccups will always happen.
Yes.
But the better prepped you are, the more you can mitigate their impact on your show.
Absolutely.
You know. And yes, it's important to know, and it's and again, it's making it fun and entertaining in prep as opposed to a drag.
Yes,
is I think part of the mental state you have to be in.
And actually, I'll just swing this back around to some of the other stuff that we're doing. So, like in the comics world, especially you know, with Deadtown, with this Back to Earth project we've been working on. Some of our other original material and other projects that we're kind of getting off the ground with other creators. You know, one of the things that I've definitely come to appreciate, which fits into this context, is, you know, in that scenario and that type of project, the pre-production is in the kind of the design work.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, one of the things that we've actually just been dealing with as we've been wrapping up the comic part of the Back to Earth series is, you know, realizing, okay, we're about to land on these last few pages of this script and of the series, and, you know, we had not done any character design or concept art, you know, to figure out, like, you know, it's a new location, new characters, new stuff happening in these last couple of pages. Now, in this particular case, we hadn't had the time to do that work up until this point. But, you know, we've had a little back and forth with the rest of the team kind of figuring out, like, okay, like, now we're getting into this last scene. It's a completely new thing that we haven't seen before.
We've seen. Yeah.
So there is actually some stuff to figure out. And, you know, there was a kind of desire, you know, from part of the team to just kind of jump into it and just, okay, well, we'll just knock out these last couple of pages. And yes, everybody wants to get this done. But I think, you know, what I realized and had to kind of push for is, like, we actually need to take a step back here.
Yes.
And, you know, figure out, you know, what does this stuff look like? How do we tell the story in a way that, you know, is both what we need from a kind of meta story, since this does tie into other pieces as far as this larger world that is created in this, you know, back to Earth universe. And also, you know, to keep the storytelling clear and you know, make sense for the reader. So, you know, I think it's in that case, you know, one thing that we did, I think, very effectively with Dead Town and with Steven is, you know, we had done so much pre-production development work with the concept there that, you know, we were able to provide him with a bunch of material, and he was able to do, you know, that kind of pre-production, you know, design process on his end. So that as we go into each chapter of the Dead Town series, whether it's on Yarn or on Macroverse, you know, the first thing that Steven actually does is sort of actually literally kind of build sets and figure out, like, okay, this is a location that we're going into. Like, what is the geography of this location? And so, like, we're going into season 3 and 4 of Dead Town on Yarn. And one of the conversations I had with him last week was like, okay, this kind of the climax of the entire series takes place in a particular area of, you know, downtown in our fictional city that we're we know where it is, but we're never going to say.
Yeah.
In this city that this is all happening in. You know, so it's like, you know, there's a very particular way that plays out.
Yes.
And he and I were literally kind of drawing maps back and forth to, yes, each other of, like, you know, what is the geography of this scene, so that if this character is here and this character is here, what are you seeing as they look across to each other, and where is that in relation to the place that they're trying to get to? And so kind of figuring that stuff out ahead of time gives him the tools that he needs to now, yes, you know, actually go and create those sequences.
Right.
And it's, you know, it's very similar in the sense of, like, you know, again, kind of knowing what you're going into before the actual real quote unquote work begins just facilitates that process in such a more, you know, once that work is done, it's like, it's so much easier to actually,
exactly,
do the thing.
Oh yeah. And I think, and that comes in the live action portion as well.
Yeah.
This is actually maybe an interesting, might be, I think, a bigger topic. But it is the, like, how do you break down sequences that take place in the real world, but potentially different points of view are happening on different,
right,
sets.
Yes.
And so you may have the bulk of a set piece takes place, the bulk of a set piece takes place outside
or
a bar.
Or the set piece. Yeah.
A set piece, fine too. But you have the bar interior is separate from the bar exterior,
yeah,
and then the shot across the view across the street as takes place in a different part of the world. The view out from the bar is,
right,
not in the same place as the immediate exterior.
Yeah.
And so you have to split up all your scenes and therefore your shots in such a way that, great, if we're looking into the bar, we're on stage.
Right.
If we're looking out of the bar, then we're actually on this location. And if,
right,
we're looking across the street, we're in somewhere totally different.
Right.
And so how do you track all these different things,
yeah,
so that the scene itself comes together? And you have no idea that
these
things
are places,
yeah, immediately proximate.
Yes.
But they take place in three different places,
yeah,
and this is just part of the process.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very cool. So moving on,
yes,
a couple of quick updates. I'm not sure if you actually saw this, but as of yesterday, the Dead Town series on the Yarn platform has now gotten to 2.3 million impressions and
very
views,
nice,
which is very cool.
Yep.
So very cool to see that number just keep going up and up and up. Season 3 and 4, as we mentioned, are now written. And season 3, Steven has finished all of the creative assets for, so we're kind of putting the last bits of that together to deliver. He's working on all the season 4 stuff now, so that is all scheduled out, and actually season 3 is going to launch, I don't remember the exact date, but basically you can look for both of those, which will actually finish out the breakout,
yes,
series, is going to launch in early September.
Yes.
So that will all be coming very soon, and very excited about that. And then
and we'll also lots of nice Easter eggs into the comic series.
Lots of fun Easter eggs. So if you're enjoying Dead Town on either the Yarn platform or on our Macroverse platform, there are some pretty fun tie-ins if you're eagle-eyed and paying attention between the two series.
Which we assume you are.
Yes. Episode 9 of Dead Town on Macroverse, all the art and creative has been completed for that as well. So we're putting the last of the pre-production together on our end as well. So that will be launching within the next couple of weeks also, with lots more to come. Yes. So lots of good Dead Town stuff coming, lots more to say about all this other Yarn stuff that we're working on over the next few weeks as well. The rest of the train keeps on moving. Yes. If you happen to be in Los Angeles and are familiar with the Lemley Theater chain, Lemley is one of the classic names in kind of old Hollywood cinema. So the Lemley brothers were the earliest, I'm not sure if they were the founders, but they were certainly the early people that ran Universal Studios.
Yep. If you go to the Universal, if you are not the Universal Studios, the tourist part of it, if you go to the studio part of it, there is the kind of Carl Lemley buildings and offices and parking structures and all these various things.
So they ran Universal. They may have founded it as well. I'm ashamed to now not be clear on that, but they're definitely responsible for all the classic Universal monster movies and all that stuff. When the government came in and broke up essentially ruled that the studios could no longer own theaters, they actually went and took the exhibition side and started Lemley Theaters as a kind of in that separation. So Universal kind of went off and continued their production side. They took the exhibition side. And so, Lemley Theaters is one of the premier art house cinemas here in Los Angeles. I think they're up to 9 or 10 different theaters at this point. So there's a new one just opened in Glendale. We've done a bunch of work for Lemley over the years, and the latest stuff is this series of short animated pieces. The most recent one that has come out is in theaters now. So if you want to see something that we made, go to a Lemley theater in Los Angeles. And it's a very fun little Dr. Frankenstein inspired short that celebrates the launch of this, the opening of this new theater in Glendale. So that'll go up on our website shortly as well if you're not in LA.
All but featuring the Lemley.
It's a very fun little spot. It's very black and white, grainy, fun, old school, very fun, cartoony little piece. So it's been a lot of fun to work on.
Yep.
So that is out right now. And again, we'll go up on the website shortly if you want to see that as well. In other news, what in the world, Adam, is a Hujima flip?
I feel a Hujima flip is whatever is top of mind at the moment, but you can't quite remember the name of.
Yes. As I like to call it, it's the British whatchamacallit.
Yeah, right, exactly.
So Adam coined this phrase, and we've adopted it as our kind of top of mind thing of the week. So so what have you been thinking about this week?
Actually, for me, it's funny. It's been a bit, having seen Mission Impossible last weekend, and just being kind of in the thick of it. It's pop culture wise, I have sad to say that I haven't been as on it as I normally am. But
welcome to my world.
Yeah, right, exactly. I don't even have a small children.
I know.
Two very media savvy kids. We did see, so I think the two things for me. One is, one of the joys of living in LA is you get to do these kind of big entertainment things.
Yes.
And Star Wars at the Hollywood Bowl with a live orchestra on Friday night is just delightful. It's so
explain
amazing.
Explain this setup, because it is truly extraordinary.
Right. So it's all right. So you're at the Hollywood Bowl, which like most people are probably familiar with. So a big bowl, big kind of natural bowl in the Hollywood Hills, with a large stage kind of at the bottom of it, and they have a number of large screens set around the around the
theater. So would you say it's like an outdoor concert
hall?
It's
a big outdoor concert venue, basically.
Yeah.
In a kind of natural recess in the Hollywood Hills. And it's, you have, they have lots, they have, the summer months in LA, lots and lots of different concerts, and it ranges from jazz to, I mean, we saw Imagine Dragons last year there with the kids. We saw Rodrigo and Gabriella there before. John Williams does every year. He does a couple of performances where he conducts his own music, which is just stunning. And of course, it's full of rabid Star Wars fans. So everyone comes with both wands, because, you know, he did the initial Harry Potter music, and of course lightsabers galore for the John Williams material. And then they'll do a number of just movies of various kinds that they'll show, with the LA Phil being conducted by Dudamel, one of the kind of big one of the big LA Phil conductors. And it's just a wonderful experience, because you're surrounded by, especially with the Star Wars, you're surrounded by these kind of uber fans of the series. And what I hadn't realized, you know, I will say this, so my children are very well trained in terms of, they go to movies or shows, they've been going to the opera since they were 3 years old.
Yeah.
They know how to, you know, they go up, they expect to go to a theater or a show, and they sit quietly and watch. They don't like to be disturbed. And my 10-year-old will get incredibly annoyed with his friends when they talk during a movie. He's like, no, shut up, I want to watch the film. And of course, you know, none of us were quite expecting this, but we showed up, and everyone has lightsabers. And in all the kind of classic lines, moments in the movies, everyone's cheering, and the lightsabers will come out across the arena. It's just wonderful.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen Star Wars on the big screen in probably 15 years. And that was amazing. It was just great. It was just what,
so much
and it's
fun.
Also so funny, because you realize that it's such a deeply flawed movie in so many ways. And yet maintains its magic.
Yes.
It just great. So that is absolutely my hoodlum.
So much fun. And I did not make it this time, but I have actually seen that show at the Bowl, it's fun to see a movie there. I think it's even more magical to see some of the concert things that they do there. I think the last time I went in a Star Wars related fashion was Anthony Daniels introducing.
We went together.
That's right. Yeah. So Anthony Daniels introducing as kind of the master of ceremonies for the, you know, they were playing the films, but then live performance of the music.
He's got musical highlights of all the first six, basically.
Yeah,
this was pre Force Awakens.
Exactly. Yeah. So great. And unfortunately, of course, the next night was the night that John Williams came and conducted. But but so much fun. This is not my Ujima flip, but I will also say, if you are in the Los Angeles area, the other phenomenally fun thing to do along in the same vein is they do movies in the Hollywood Cemetery, which is also just so great. And so it's basically this, you know, big outdoor, you know, kind of group, you know, definitely kind of the ultimate kind of communal movie going experience, where you bring blankets and maybe a bottle of wine and some food, and kind of have a little picnic on the lawn, and then they play a movie, and it's projected on the side
of the mausoleum. Exactly. It's amazing. Yeah,
and usually like with someone, you know, usually someone that's in the film comes and talks. And so I saw Pee-wee's Big Adventure there not long ago, or, you know, years ago, but, you know, Pee-wee came and talked about the movie. It was just so much fun. And they did this kind of ongoing series of just this sort of, classic cult
films. One of those things so we did, I think I may have talked about this before, but we did 2001, had its 40th, 50th anniversary recently. And so we went to the kind of 10 a.m. showing at the Cinerama Dome.
Yeah.
And Chris Nolan came out to introduce the movie. Like, oh, wait, this is why I live here. This is amazing.
It's great. So great. Yeah, so there's those kinds of like things in this area especially are just so much fun.
Just
so
incredibly lucky.
If you do happen to be in this area, seek them out. It's well worth it.
Well worth it.
So I am going to once again cheat and have two Ujima floaties. So one pop culture related, which is I have recently discovered a show on Stars. I talked about American Gods, which I really liked, but there's another show on Stars called Power. So I heard a podcast with the creators of Power a little while ago, and that actually got me intrigued about it, and then realized, hey, there are four seasons of this. Perfect thing to put on while I'm working on other stuff. So I've been lettering issue 2 2 of the Back to Earth series this week, and kind of getting that all ready to go to print and actually to pitch to publishers and that kind of stuff. So I've been watching a bunch of Power, and I've landed in season 4 now. So Power is one of these shows that, you know, it's got a very soap element to it. So there's mm-hmm. a lot of kind of like, you know, dramatic up and down character relationships and all that stuff, but it's actually really compelling, you know, good storytelling and, you know, compelling, interesting characters. It's very Shakespearean in a lot of ways with the, you know, kind of the kind of hardened, the basic premise is these sort of hardened drug dealers that came up on the street to rise to the kind of top dogs in, you know, kind of drug distribution. And then one of them really kind of wants to go straight and have this kind of more normal life. Like, he's laundered the money to a point where he's, you know, basically built these nightclubs that have become successful. And so he's got this sort of veneer of true kind of respectability and success, and sort of is drawn towards that kind of life as right. opposed to staying on the street and doing this, you know, kind of drug game. And then his partner and childhood friend has no interest in that. So it's this sort of interesting conflict between the two of them, but this family dynamic with how close they are and the kind of, you know, the betrayals and the not betrayals and the, you know, yes. the old girlfriend that comes back into it that, you know, he always wanted to be with, who, you know, likes the respectable businessman, but then she turns out to be a DA who's investigating all this drug stuff. So it's very soap opera-y, but lots of fun and very, very entertaining. And 50 Cent is in it, and also one of the producers.
Yeah.
He's great in the show, I will say. But one of the things that caught my interest in listening to the podcast was they were talking about, like, this is one of those shows that's never really caught on in kind of a mass audience. Mm-hmm. And yet it actually is an incredibly successful show. Like, it does, you know, big viewership numbers. Yeah. It just doesn't it's never hit the cultural zeitgeist in the way that, right. you know, other, you know, HBO shows or those sorts of things have. But it's an interesting, you know, conversation point kind of in the climate that we're in that, you know, it's a very multicultural show, you mm-hmm. know, very, very, you know, black lead and a lot of you know, people of color in all the kind of main roles or most of the main roles. And what the showrunner and kind of creator of the show is talking about is, it's like, it's this weird kind of thing where it's never kind of caught the cultural zeitgeist, but it's really captured this very specific audience in a very mm-hmm. you know, kind of big way. I find that interesting. I don't know exactly what to say about, but I think it's another example of, you know, catering to audiences that are just not served by a lot of other right. things, and finding that, you know, good material that speaks to a particular group of people can, you know, really speak to that group of people and be very successful, even if it's not something that is, right. you know, seen or kind of talked about in the way that something like Game of Thrones or, yes. you know, other things are. But it's a really enjoyable show. So I definitely recommend it.
Nice.
The other thing which I just discovered this week, which I will also recommend, is a podcast called Zigzag.
Huh.
So I just found this. It's a Radiotopia show, which I like a mm-hmm. lot of the shows that they make or that they support. And it's a story of these two women who were NPR producers, who quit their job to start their own company. So in a lot of ways has a lot of similarity to Startup and Gimlet Media, which is kind of, it's them, sharing their journey essentially as they start this company.
Right.
What's unique about it is that they are also all tied into the crypto world, which is kind of interesting, cryptocurrency world. So they're, you know, they're exploring, like, do we raise money? Do we talk to VCs? And they, you know, they go through some of that process, but they also have this connection to an interesting startup that the one of the founders of Ethereum has put a bunch of money into this company that's it's a startup as well, but it's essentially trying to democratize news media through blockchain and crypto. So essentially saying, can we find a way to provide accountability to journalism through this sort of irrefutable ledger that blockchain provides.
Interesting.
And so it's very interesting kind of listening to the way that they talk about it. And it's actually been an interesting, you know, like we've become kind of interested in this whole blockchain stuff through Back to Earth and just other things that we've been exposed to. And it's interesting kind of this point of view on it, which is not about the kind of a lot of the blockchain stories or the crypto stories, you know, kind of about, you know, oh, we raised $150 million by issuing a, you know, a coin or that sort of thing. But it's rather this kind of very intentional concept of, can we create this, you know, kind of group of journalists that can be truly vetted and held accountable for the type of material that they're putting out, where, you know, you don't have some of the complications that we have on other platforms, where those platforms are not designed to do that.
Right.
Whereas this one really is. And so it's an interesting kind of point of view on how reporting works and how you can verify and validate reporting, and do it through a kind of new technology platform that, you know, potentially has the power to actually truly verify the material. Yes. So it's very interesting. And so I definitely, you know, I both from a kind of entrepreneurship and startup, you know, journey, as well as this sort of extra crypto, you know, new platform concept.
Yep.
It's really interesting. So that's a show called Zigzag. I'm enjoying it very much. Season one is now out, so you can go binge the whole thing. yeah, it's been fun to listen to that.
Great stuff.
So with that, this is actually episode 50. Of our podcast.
It's a half century.
So we're half century old.
Excellent.
We'll have to figure out something to do for number 52, because I feel like that's a true kind of big milestone. We've 50 episodes in. It's pretty awesome. Good. Yeah.
It's not bad.
Lots more to come. Yep. As always, you can find us and follow us on all the social medias
at M2 Action.
Definitely download and check out our app, Macroverse. Mm-hmm. We believe the future of comics.
Yep.
You can also find Macroverse on social media at Macroverse App. And if you check the show notes, we'll put links to the stuff that we talked about, as well as the links to download Macroverse, as well as a direct link into the Yarn series that we talked about for Dead Town. All kinds of other goodies in there as
good stuff coming along.
So lots more to come, and with that, have a good week.
Bye.
Bye.